This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcast, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, we have a great show for you today. We have a returning guest, a favorite here on the Old Dogs REI Network, one who has been on two other episodes in the past. One was called The ABCs of Multifamily Syndication, and the other, How to Become a Successful Syndicator. Well, if you didn't guess by now, I will tell you who that person was we interviewed. Kim Lisa Taylor. She's an author, real estate investor, and nationally recognized speaker, and is founder of Syndication Attorneys PLLC, a Florida law firm that helps entrepreneurs create successful investment companies. She and the other members of the Syndication Attorneys team focus on helping small businesses. She and other members of the Syndication Attorneys team focus on helping small business owners, developers, structure and convey their investment opportunities in a way that will attract private investors, both domestic and foreign. They teach their clients how to use securities laws effectively and provide them the tools and resources they need to achieve their business goals legally. An attorney since 2002, Kim has made corporate securities law her primary focus since 2008. She has written more than 300 securities offerings and numerous joint venture agreements. Kim is also the author of How to Legally Raise Private Money, the definitive guide to syndication and raising money for real estate and small business. So, Kim, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be back.
Well, it's great having you back all the time. Every time you've been has just been just an absolute plethora of information. And I'm really looking forward to today. Since it's been a while since we talked, maybe you could just kind of give us an idea of sort of what you've been up to and any new things that you should share with our audience here.
So for right now, we've still been running the firm. We've survived COVID and actually done quite well. We're seeing a lot of momentum right now in 2021 with new deals coming across our table and new clients coming to us, a lot of returning clients. We've also started an investor marketing materials platform called investormarketingmaterials.com. where we have employed professional editors and graphic designers that can help you create professionally designed marketing materials that you can use to impress your investors and keep them coming back.
That sounds nice. Yeah, well, is there a link to that, or is that something that mainly happens with your clients?
No, they can get to it from syndicationattorneys.com. There's an investor materials tab, or they can go directly to investormarketingmaterials.com, and they can actually see the products and the pricing right there on the website.
Ah, fantastic. Well, you know, you and I were talking offline before we started, and one of the challenges I know a lot of folks have is they're growing their portfolio, and you know, they're buying property after property after property, and comes that point where all of a sudden, you know, your funds are limited or tied up, or you know, maybe they're all in your properties, but you want to go forward and you still want to expand that portfolio before you have to wait around for some equity plays you could do, you know, later down the road. And one of the things that folks do when they really, you know, reach that point is to go into partnerships. And today, this is going to be the topic of our discussion here. And I thought maybe you might want to just give us a little idea of what that looks like. So somebody comes to you, they say, "Look, I've got this great deal, but I, you know, for some reason or other, maybe they don't want to do a syndication." But you know, they have some potential partners out there that they could come along with. You know, what does that look like? And you know, maybe you could give some tips here as to how people should know when it's that time to go into partnerships.
Well, so usually it happens because somebody finds something, they get it under contract. Typically, it's going to be a smaller deal, where, you know, maybe they only need to raise $200,000 or $300,000, maybe even less, and they want to bring in some people who will be actively involved with them, and so there becomes a point at which syndication makes sense, but then there's a point below which it doesn't make sense. So, for instance, in a syndication, if you have bringing in a large group of investors, you don't want them all actively involved in telling you what to do. And so when you have passive investors, that's when you fall into the securities world and you have to start complying with securities laws. But if you want to have a very small group of investors where everyone is going to stay actively involved in generating their own profits, then you can do a joint venture. Typically, that's going to be structured as a member-managed LLC, where all of the members are considered to be managing members. And they all have, you know, rights and duties to contract and bind the company, to open and close bank accounts, and to make active decisions about what's happening with their money.
Got it. And do they all have equal ownership, or is it, it just depends on the deal structure?
Well, it could be based on how much, you know, percentage interest can be allocated based on how much somebody invests. It's possible to even carve out a piece of or percentage ownership for people who are contributing not capital, but sweat equity. And if you're somebody who's going to be contributing capital and sweat equity, then you're going to want to, and where other people are contributing maybe less sweat equity, then you're going to want to make sure that you've got maybe a disproportionate allocation of ownership.
Gotcha. Well, let's zero in on that sweat equity person, for example. There are a lot of folks that are just, you know, very bright. They know a lot about investing. They know, you know, how to analyze a market and a property, and you know, just they can do a lot of the operational side as well as the acquisition side. Well, let's say somebody has those skill sets, and they. But they don't have the funds to come into a project, and they may not be able to contribute anything, but they're looking for somebody to help fund this project, or it could be multiple people. Let's keep it simple though, and just say maybe it's just one person. What would that look like, and how would you structure a deal like that?
Well, so that's you know, pretty typical. But you have to be super careful here, because you're walking a fine line between when do you cross over into the world of securities and now you have to set up a syndicate and start complying with securities laws. And that fine line is making sure that even though you might be doing the bulk of the sweat equity and the, you know, the grunt work, you're actually still involving all of those investors actively in you know, making decisions more than just a voting right. It has to be more than just a voting right. So maybe you want to, you know, allocate titles to people, and, you know, maybe one person's in charge of accounting and somebody else is in charge of keeping track of property managers, and somebody else does the due diligence, you know. So you really need to kind of allocate the tasks amongst yourselves so that you don't inadvertently, you know, call it a joint venture and then actually treat it like a security, because it's not what you call it. It's how you actually operate the company that's going to determine whether you actually sold a joint venture interest or a security. And where that's going to get you in trouble is if the deal goes bad and all of a sudden, you know, the investors are losing money or they're not getting what had been promised to them. And they start complaining maybe to attorneys or to regulators. And then those regulators start scrutinizing the deal and say, well, wait a minute, they called it a joint venture, but then this guy made all the decisions and he did all the work. So he really, this was a passive investment. These guys were passive investors. He didn't follow securities laws. So, you know, he's in trouble for that. It's not a joint venture.
Right, right. Taking it to maybe that simple focus of just one investor, one other person that's involved who would also maybe share in this deal. Let's say he agrees to, look, I'll do all this, you know, all the back end stuff. So this person just wants to put money in. They want to get a good return.
So yeah, in that situation, you really need to be setting it up like a securities offering, because it doesn't fall into then the definition of a joint venture where everyone is actively involved in generating their own profits.
Okay, joint venture would only entail somebody that was actively participating in the process?
That's correct.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
As soon as they stop actively participating, you know, if they're too busy or they're just not doing it, you know, you're really not, it's not a joint venture anymore.
Okay, so it goes into what, more like a hard money loan or something like that?
Well, no, it's just, okay, so let's just kind of back up a minute and say, okay, well, what is a syndication? Well, first of all, what is a security? Okay, so when do you trigger securities laws? You trigger securities laws when you're selling securities. How do you know if you're selling securities? Well, the definition that applies to most real estate investors is an investment of money in a common enterprise with an expectation of profits based solely on the efforts of the promoter. Okay, so if you have an investment that meets that criteria where you've got the investment of money in a common enterprise, an expectation of profits, then you've got this fourth element, this based solely on the efforts of the promoter, you've created something called an investment contract. Investment contracts are listed within the definition of securities. So if you're selling investment contracts, you're selling securities. So this is going to apply to any kind of limited partnership where you have a general partner who's doing all the work and limited partners who are contributing money. That by definition, if the limited partners are contributing money, that's going to be those limited partnership interests are going to be considered securities in the form of investment contracts. Same thing with an LLC. When you're forming an LLC, there's two ways to form it. You form it as member managed, meaning that all of the members are considered to be managing members, or you can form it as manager managed, where only, you know, one or two people or maybe another LLC is appointed as the manager. They're going to do all the work and expend all the effort, and then the other people are passively investing. So if you're in a manager managed LLC where the manager is doing all the work and the members are passively investing, then you've also sold those investment contracts. So that's the key. And then the difference as far as the SEC is concerned is, you know, their test is if everyone is actively involved in generating their own profits, we won't consider them to be passive investors. Therefore, you didn't meet that test that I gave, that's called the four-prong Howey test. So you'd have an investment of money in a common enterprise with an expectation of profits, but you don't have that fourth element. It's not based solely on the efforts of the promoter, because it's based on everybody's efforts. So there is the distinction between a joint venture and a security.
Gotcha. Okay, so looking at just another on another angle here, somebody flipping a house, and they've got a private investor, private money, and that that investor, you know, they share with them what they anticipate to make on this deal, how much it'll be to rehab it, how much money it'll be to, what's the ARV, the after repair value. And then they just basically agree, okay, here's the money, go for it. And we'll split it, whatever percentage we're going to split it. Why would that be any different, for, let's say, an apartment as opposed to a single family flip?
Well, so again, we're going to go back to what is the contractual agreement between these two parties? And so there's two options. One, it could be a private loan, right? So this person is loaning the money and there's a promissory note. So that's going to be treated a little bit differently, but it's surprising for some people to learn that promissory notes are still considered securities. And when you get into a business that depends on repeatedly borrowing money from private investors, you then are selling securities. And when we have clients that come to us that are doing that, we create a note offering for them. So it's going to look a lot like a regular syndicate where we're going to have a disclosure document. But instead of having an LLC operating agreement or a limited partnership agreement, there's going to be a promissory note that is the contractual agreement between the person who's promoting the deal and the investor. So that's one way that could be handled. And we would still say that at some point, you know, if you're doing an isolated transactions, one or two a year, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Or if you're borrowing money from people who are in the business of lending money, hard money lenders, you know, banks, anybody that's holding themselves out to be a lender, I wouldn't be worried too much about whether you're selling them securities. But when you're going and you're approaching your neighbors and your friends and other people who aren't in the business, that's when you're going to fall into that category of these notes are going to be treated as securities and you have to follow securities laws. So the second option under that single family scenario would be to form an LLC and have that investor invest, you know, that investor puts up the money, you do the work. Again, if you don't have that investor actively involved in generating their own profits, then that would not fall, you know, that would be considered a security as well. If that investor was an accredited investor, you know, probably nobody's ever going to complain about it. They're smart enough to take care of their own interests. They're probably going to stay involved enough to protect their interests anyway. You know, it's not going to be that big of a deal. But if you're starting to bring in people who are not accredited investors, that's when the regulators start to pay attention. And of course, nothing is going to happen unless the deal fails and you don't perform. I mean, I happened to run across somebody not too long ago that was involved in a bunch of single family transactions and had 11 lawsuits against them for fraud. So
wow.
There was something going on where they weren't, you know, the deals failed, they weren't performing, you know, something was happening, and that person was being sued for not performing. And whether they were structured as joint ventures or whether they were structured as securities, I don't know, but I'm sure that that came up during litigation.
Wow. Yeah, I know a lot of folks, you know, trying to make that transition from maybe smaller properties to larger properties, especially if they're going to get into, say, agency debt, for example, if they don't have the experience or the net worth, sometimes they don't have an option, of course, to partner or to do a syndication with people that do have that net worth to be able to, you know, cover that loan. Can they do that from a joint venture standpoint? I don't know if you know how banks would look at that as opposed to a syndication. Do banks feel more comfortable lending to syndication versus the JV?
Well, they're going to want all the people. So if it's a member managed LLC that the bank is loaning the money to, then they're going to probably want to underwrite every single member. So every single member has to be capable of being underwritten. So if there's some reason that you can't be underwritten, that structure isn't necessarily going to work for you. the normal thing with a bank is that they want to know that the person that they're that's guaranteeing the loan is ultimately responsible for the final decisions on that property if the deal starts to tank. So they're going to be looking to either have that person in a majority ownership position or in as the manager of a manager-managed LLC so that they can know that that person is the one who's making the build's final decisions if things go wrong.
I see. Got it. What situations are sort of prime for JV versus syndication?
So that's a really great question. We don't recommend that. I mean, so if you're raising less than, you know, $300,000, you probably want to try to structure it as a joint venture or, you know, in a way that you're not really having to comply with securities laws because the legal costs can be a little bit disproportionate to the raise. But if you're going to have more than three or four in other members whom you know very, very well, you really don't want those people. You don't want 10 or 15 people all actively involved in telling you what to do and having to try to get, unanimous decisions from all of those people or even majority decisions from all of those people to make major decisions about the property could become cumbersome. So we just recommend if you're going to have more than three or four investors, don't do a joint venture. Treat it as a syndicate. Understand that, you know, there's ways to comply with securities laws. You just have to learn how to do it. And once you understand how to do it, it's not that difficult. And there's ways that you can keep it less cost disproportionate, for instance, by only including accredited investors. So you don't have to have a private placement memorandum and, you know, keeping your deals kind of smaller. But once you start having more than three or four investors, you're really going to want to create that, you know, manager-managed LLC or a limited partnership so that you're in control and you can make the decisions and the investors are passively investing with you.
Gotcha. And do you, with the... Yeah, on the joint venture side, you mentioned, I mean, just sort of an arbitrary number. I don't know if that's something that sort of a rule of thumb, but would you say that a deal size would have to be a certain amount to go into syndication versus a joint venture or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, we have clients that do syndications for as little as $400,000 raise. But if it's less than that, then again, you may want to be looking at some other alternative. And maybe that is a place where you want to do a note offering instead of doing LLCs. Or you could do a series of joint ventures and just keep your membership numbers small enough that it doesn't become problematic.
Right. With a syndication, just looking from that standpoint, you mentioned, having too many decision makers. And maybe it's a rule of thumb, or maybe it's just some wisdom from your part. What do you recommend for people that are syndicating? If they have 10 GPs or 20 GPs in there, doesn't that make it also difficult to manage and get everybody's approval?
Yeah, I think that's problematic on a number of fronts. We're back to the same thing. You shouldn't do a joint venture if there's more than three or four people. And so we frequently use a joint venture structure within the structure of a syndicate. So let me just explain that. When we're structuring a securities offering with a manager-managed LLC, then we will have the manager-managed LLC will be the investor-level entity. So that's the company that's probably going to take title to the property and then sell off a portion of its ownership interests to investors, and the management team will keep a portion of those ownership interests for itself. The manager of that manager-managed LLC is usually comprised of two to four people. And so we would also create an LLC for the manager. That LLC at the management level can either be a member-managed LLC where everybody's actively involved, okay? Or it can be a manager-managed LLC. Well, the reason that we might want to do one versus the other is that situation we were talking about before, where maybe only two of those four members in the management are going to sign on the loan. Then the lender will want those two people who are signing on the loan to be the managers of that management level entity. And then all four of those people can be members of that management entity. So we always have to try to think about what does the bank want and what's going to help them get that loan approved and get your deal to the closing table. So we're always trying to think of how to create the least amount of friction and to get that done.
So having less people that are being underwritten there, in that case, you're saying would probably be an easier way to get that loan qualified, right?
That's right. And then you had mentioned, you know, having a management level entity, you know, and we're kind of using the term general partner and manager of a manager managed LLC interchangeably. So, and they are really the same thing. So a general partner is the management entity of a limited partnership, and the manager is the management level of a manager managed LLC. And so we need to be just thinking about how within that management LLC, how many people can feasibly run that company. And, you know, you mentioned a situation where you could have 16 or 20, and I would argue that any management LLC with 16 or 20 people in it is doomed to fail. In fact, my experience has been that more than five people in a management entity of a syndicate is very problematic. I've never yet seen one get to the closing table without some kind of dissension among the group and somebody dropping out. And in the worst case, I even saw a lawsuit happen immediately after closing on the property, because you have too many opinions and people who are trying to run the show. So you really need to keep the management of your syndicates manageable. I have to use a pun.
Gee whiz. Well, what do you actually put the property under when you've got that? Yeah, you talked about that manager LLC, and then you've got the other LLC. Is it the manager LLC that is actually on the deed?
No, it's the other one. Oh, it's the investment level LLC that's going to take title to the property and sell off the interest to the investors. That just happens to be a manager managed LLC, and the manager of it is going to be the you know, the operational unit where all the managerial day-to-day decisions are being made. Within that investor level entity, we're going to draft an operating agreement that talks about what the manager's rights and duties are to that LLC and what the passive member's rights and duties are. And usually the passive members will have limited voting rights only on certain major decisions, but we'll try to reserve some of the more common things for the management, such as the decision whether to go forward and buy the property, or the decision to refinance the property, or the decision to sell the property. We want the manager to be able to make those decisions without involving the members. But then if you want to, instead of selling the property, maybe you want to do a 1031 exchange and buy a different property and keep that same group of investors going forward into the next deal, that would be something that you'd want those members to vote on and agree to.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Anything else in the JV area that you feel is significant that we didn't address?
Well, there's another way that JVs come into play in relation to syndicates. And this is just kind of the, you know, we're doing the hierarchy. We're starting at the small deals. You got two or three people getting together. They're doing a deal and everybody's actively involved. Then we're going kind of graduating up to the next level where we're going to create an actual syndicate. But the management level is still going to be a joint venture. But there's a third way that JVs become involved with syndicates. And that's when you're getting into really big deals and maybe you're starting to raise $4 or $5 million or more per deal, you know, independent of what the lender is providing, then you might want to consider doing some kind of a joint venture agreement with a private equity company or a family office or an institutional investor that's going to come in for half or more of that raise. And in that case, you actually end up with your syndicate structure that we talked about before. But that syndicate is now a side-by-side investor or a member of a bigger member-managed LLC with this private equity company, with the private equity company being the other member, the other joint venture member. So those can get a little complex. When we start doing deals like that, you'll have as many as five LLCs in a deal, one to own the property, then you'll have the joint venture entity that owns the title holding entity, and then you'll have within that the private equity company will have its own structure, and then your syndicate's going to have its own structure with its manager and its members. So that's also a way that joint ventures are used quite frequently in real estate deals.
Wow. That definitely gets more complicated. We just in our sort of our remaining time here, we've got about 5 or 6 more minutes here. I thought maybe you could kind of update us too. I know there's a lot going on in just the real estate sphere in general, but specifically in the area of SEC law, maybe things that are being proposed or that we need to look out for ahead. Anything that you could update us on?
Sure. There were three recent SEC updates that two of them have been enacted and one has not, but all three are relevant to our clients and to your audience. So the accredited investor definition was updated, and that became effective in December. So there's been a few categories of accredited investors added. One of them would be a couple, doesn't have to be married anymore in order to qualify as accredited. So a cohabitating couple can pool their resources together to qualify as an accredited investor. Any company with $5 million or more in assets can be qualified as an accredited investor. And there are a few more categories, but those are the ones that are the most important. There was a big deal made about the fact that the SEC has added these new categories for professionals, but then they limited the professionals who could qualify to those who have certain securities licenses. And the fallacy there is that those investors or those securities licensees are probably prohibited from investing in private offerings by their employers. So it's difficult for that to be meaningful. But the SEC did reserve the right to be able to add other professional categories by rule instead of having to go through this long, protracted rulemaking process that they did before. So, we're hopeful that at some point they'll add, attorneys, doctors, CPAs, people with advanced degrees or finance degrees or, some other ability to be able to qualify other than just by income. So that came into effect. There is another new rule where the SEC kind of went in and they called it harmonization of exemptions, where they tried to look at all the different exemptions that are available and kind of see where there were kind of disparities between the different rules and tried to make them more consistent. So they've actually done some clarification that if you close one offering before you start another offering, as long as there's a 30-day gap in between when you stop raising money for one and start raising money for the other, that the two of them wouldn't be considered part of the same offering, which is important because if you wanted to do a Rule 506B offering following a Rule 506C offering, so 506C is an advertised offering, 506B is an offering that can be advertised, then, as long as you had that 30-day gap in between the two, that they wouldn't be considered part of the same offering. So you wouldn't run afoul of the advertising rules in either case. So there's some things like that they did, and they raised some limits for Regulation A+, raised from $50 million a year to $75 million a year for Tier 2 offerings. And they also raised regulation crowdfunding offering limits from $1 million to $5 million, which is pretty substantial. The third thing that is, the one that we're really kind of just hoping still moves forward is that there was a proposed finder's rule that would allow people who don't have securities licenses to actually receive commissions for referring accredited investors to other people's deals. and they created, they proposed a couple of different categories, one that would apply to people who just do it on a one-time basis, and another one that would apply for people who are doing it more frequently. And that was just proposed prior to the change in administration. So we don't know if that's just going to get dropped or if it's going to at some point move forward. The public comment period did end. So we'll just kind of wait and see if that happens.
Wow, that's great. Great information. Yeah, I wonder what that would be. That'd be awesome if that did go forward. But yeah, it's tough between administrations. You don't know what's going to happen. Well, Kim, this has been great having you back again. Good information, especially the JV stuff, which we really don't cover enough that we really need to cover here. But also the updates on what's going on in the SEC is real important, too. So I cannot thank you enough.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. And I'm sure we'll have you back many more times because you have a lot of great information for our listeners. So,
I would like to say one last thing is that there are some articles at our website at syndicationattorneys.com. There's an article in the library called JVs versus Securities. What's the difference? And there are three other articles about these SEC updates. So if you want to read about any of that stuff, just go to syndicationattorneys.com and check it out.
And how can people reach you if they need to?
If they want to schedule a free consultation with me or my other securities attorney, they can do that at syndicationattorneys.com. There's a place where they can click a button and schedule an appointment.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks again for joining us, Kim. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
And I also want to thank all our old dog listeners out there, too. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Please note everything Kim talked about today can be accessed in our detailed show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And you're going to look for the episode with Kim Lisa Taylor. Well, that is the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.